Coming on the Agony Column podcast, author Richard Morgan is no stranger to controversy.
In vogue at the moment, there's this idea that you mustn't upset religious people, you know. You must take their ideas seriously. Why? Why is that?
Wake up and smell the burning flesh.
If a guy comes in and says he's been abducted by aliens, you don't take him seriously. If a guy comes in and says he's been talking to Jesus on the phone, you don't take him seriously.
It's your wake-up call. Coming on the Agony Column podcast. You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
The phone. He rolled awake in the still darkened room, convinced he'd only just closed his eyes. Steady blue glow digits at the bedside disputed the impression. 1709. He'd slept through the day. He held up his wrist, peering stupidly at the watch he'd forgotten to take off, as if a hotel clock could somehow be wrong. The wrist ached from the fumbling blow he'd hit Merrin with. He turned it a little, flexing. It might even be... Phone, answer the fucking... He groped for it, dragged the audio receiver up to his ear. Yeah, what? Marsalis? A voice he should know, but sleep scrambled, didn't. Is that you? Who the fuck is this? Ah, so it is you. The name came just ahead of his own belated recognition of the measured tones. Gianfranco Di Palma here, Brussels office. Carl sat up in bed, frowning. What do you want? I have just been speaking to an agent Nicholson in New York. Di Palma's perfect, barely accented UN English floated urbanely down the line. I understand that Colin have no further use for your services and that they have arranged that all charges against you in the Republic will be dropped forthwith. It seems you'll be returning to Europe very shortly. Yeah? News to me. Well, I don't think we need to wait around on formalities. I'll have a UNGLA shuttle dispatched to SFO tonight. If you would care to be at the suborbital terminal around midnight? No, I wouldn't. I'm sorry? South Florida State swirled up into his mind like dirty water backing up from a blocked drain. A sudden decision gripped him, cheery as the lettering on his stigma jacket. I said you can fuck off, Di Palma. Write it down. Fuck. Right. Off. You let me sit in a Jesus Land jail for 4 months, and I'd still be there for all the fucking effort you made to get me out, and you still owe me expenses from fucking January! And just like that, out of nowhere, he was furious, trembling with the sudden rage. So don't think for one fucking moment I'm going to jump into line just because you finally got your dick out of your own ass. I am not done here. I am very far from done here, and I'll come home when I'm fucking good and ready. There was a stiff pause at the other end of the line. You understand, I assume, said Di Palma silkily, that you are not authorized to operate without UNGLA jurisdiction. Of course, your time is your own to dispose of, but we cannot agree to you having any further professional contact with Colin or the Rim State Security Corps in the interest of... What's the matter with you, Di Palma? Don't you have a pen there? I told you to fuck off. You want me to spell it? I strongly advise you not to take this attitude. Yeah? Well, I strongly advise you to go and get a caustic soda enema. Let's see which of us takes direction best, shall we? He broke the connection, sat staring at the phone for a while.
Richard Morgan is the author of Altered Carbon, winner of the Philip K. Dick Award. His new novel is titled Black Man in the UK and has been released in the United States as a 13. Thank you for joining me, Richard.
Thanks. Always a pleasure, Rick.
Always a pleasure. This is a really interesting book on a number of levels. It's a little bit different from all your books. It feels richer, fuller, longer. Your sense of pacing is different. How did that happen?
That's a really good question. Thank you for all the compliments. I think I would admit that stylistically the book is a step up. I sort of, you know, you always hope that your next book is going to be better than the one you've just written, and you hopefully learn your trade as you go along. So I think in that sense, yes, it's a if you like, a richer book. There's more in it, and it's better balanced, better put together. It's also a much more talky book than previous ones. Despite the sort of lashings of ultraviolence, it is fundamentally a book of ideas. It's really about concepts. And, you know, in order to warn my readers out there who might be expecting just a gore fest, an awful lot of this book involves a bunch of people just sitting around talking. And in fact, central to the book is a relationship between two people, and really the book is about the two of them thrashing out their relationship and trying to work out what they mean to each other and why. That was intentional because I sort of completed three Kovacs novels. I'd done Market Forces, which is very fast and headlong, and I wanted to try something a bit more considered. And I'd also just got done with writing comic books for Marvel, where obviously the sort of the level of consideration per page is pretty low. So everything in me wanted to do something a bit more thoughtful, a bit slower, a bit more dense, maybe. I had an enormous stack of different ideas that I was interested in and playing with. There were issues about genetics, about American politics, about gender, a whole stack of stuff. And so I did what I usually do, which is to sit down and just start writing something and then see where it goes. And where it went was a very kind of jagged path. It went all over the place and took a very long time to kind of gather the kittens back into the enclosure, as it were. That's a Murakami metaphor, I think. That's stolen there. Thank you, Haruki. So it took a long time to put together. And a number of people have said so far that they feel that it's a bit unbalanced, that the pacing is uneven. And again, what that is really down to is the fact that there's a lot of talking around, there's a lot of exposition, and then there are these sudden snaps to violent chases, fights, murders, you know, and so forth. I'm not sure if that's, you know, me screwing up the pacing or, you know, a conscious desire to balance those two things out. And of course, I'm not really in a position to judge how well I've done that. That's something that the readers will have to make up their mind about. But it was a more deliberate book, I think, than anything I've written so far.
Tell us a little bit about the setup of the book. It's a fairly simple and straightforward setup. I remember when you told me back at Worldcon.
It's set 100 years from now. And the principal factor to be considered is that we've had 100 years of genetic experimentation, messing around with human genes. And this has been done with very little oversight. And as a result, you've ended up with a number of human beings who are genetically modified, not in the sense of them being, you know, sort of hulking great muscular brutes or, you know, incredibly fast or none of the sort of standard SF ideas. What's been changed really is the modular configuration of their brains. They've been rewired as embryos or before embryos. They've been rewired at the point of conception to have certain tendencies, certain enhanced tendencies. And those tendencies vary depending on what the experiment was about. You've got some who are, for example, have been designed to be very compliant and sort of do what they're told. You've got some who are designed to be very sexual. You've got some, and these are the ones we're mostly concerned with, who've been engineered to be very, very violent or to be have a capacity for violence that freed from the sort of standard issue remorse and sort of social factors that usually tie it down in normal humans. And these guys were designed as soldiers, mainly because there was a feeling that the kind of ordinary human soldiers weren't suitable any longer because the Western world was facing enemies who just had the edge in terms of desperation. Anyway, these guys, the 13s they're called, they, along with all the other genetically modified humans, have become a problem. And after a century of you know, sort of no oversight, finally, enough people have seen sense that the oversight has been brought to bear and we're dealing with the aftermath of this situation. So the story really concerns one of these guys who has been used for military purposes and is now on the scrap heap along with the rest. And it's how he's coping with life in the aftermath, really, and how everybody, the whole human race, and especially these modified humans, how they're dealing with the aftermath of this century of messing about.
The concept of the humans, especially these soldiers, divorced from the restraints of civilization is really fascinating. Is that based on research? On it sounds like it's something out of sociological research. It's fascinating stuff.
Well, it's I borrowed liberally from a lot of reading I've been doing on human genetics. It has its inspiration in reality, but it's very much, I mean, I've taken it for a very long walk, and I certainly wouldn't want to sort of claim that the stuff that I read ties directly to what I've done with this. Basically, there is a theory about, and it was written in a paper that, to my knowledge, hasn't yet seen academic publication, so, I mean, it's a fringe thing. There's an idea that the human capacity for aggression has actually shrunk over the last 15,000 years to a surprisingly radical extent. And the guys who've come up with this idea, what they think has happened is basically that as humans have gone from a sort of roving hunter-gatherer lifestyle and become increasingly settled and started to live together in denser communities, and also adopted agriculture to a greater or lesser extent. What's happened is tendencies that might work quite well in a small hunter-gatherer group, like, for example, extreme and ungovernable violence, will work much less well in this area. And the reason for that basically is because once you have a society, people have to do what they're told, because otherwise it doesn't work. And the suggestion that's being made here really is that over time, the people within these sort of seed societies, these kind of agricultural societies as they're beginning to grow up, that the ones who wouldn't fit in, the ones who won't do what they're told, and the ones who are sort of sporadically violent for no good reason, these guys get bred out. They either get kicked out of the tribe, they're exiled, they're sent away, or they're just murdered or whatever. And the guy who's been associated with this in the reading I've done, a guy called Richard Wrangham, who's actually a specialist in studying bonobos, you know, the pygmy chimpanzees in Africa, he ties this in with something that has come up in sort of primitive hunter-gatherer societies that still exist in places like Papua New Guinea, where there's an enduring tendency to have a fear of what they call witches. Now, these are usually men, they're male witches, but this fear of these sort of, they're kind of evil people, they're witches, but there's no real explanation for why they are. You know, there's a sort of supernatural tang to this thing, but it's never really very clear why these people are, you know, a problem. But anyway, they very often get murdered, and the explanation is, oh, he was a witch. And what Wrangham seemed, from, I say, I'm reading this secondhand through a Matt Ridley book where Wrangham's theories are mentioned. What seems to be the thrust of this is this idea that this is a kind of cultural hangover from the time when we were breeding out these people. You know, we were deciding, you know, violence is fine as long as it's codified, you know. So if you all get together because the guy with a beard says to you, we're going to go and kill those mothers on the other side of the valley because we want their land and their women, that's cool, that's all right. But if you've got people who suddenly get up one morning with a sore head and murder their neighbour, you know, or decide that they like the woman that the guy next door has got, and so they just kill him so that they can have the woman, that's not cool in a settled society. Not least because these guys won't do what the man with the beard says either. You know, they're a challenge to overall authority. And that fascinated me because on the one hand, it kind of exemplifies a sort of a mythologized tendency in humans, this sort of the rebellion against authority. The whole Luciferian, Oscar Wilde thing, you know, disobedience is man's original virtue, that whole thing. But it stacks it up against the fact that, yeah, if you have too many disobedient people, you can't build a civilization. You know, civilizations are built on the blood and bones of slaves and sort of compliant workers. In order to have a civilized society, you need the arts, you need writing, you need and you need a leisured class who can create these things. And the only way you get a leisured class is if they're living off the backs of the poor bastards who are out there in the field tilling the earth and bringing in the food. So you're faced with this rather depressing realization that the civilization that we have is thanks largely to sort of aeons of brutality and exploitation. Now, you fit that against the other half, this idea of these people who just won't do as they're told, and you've got this brilliant, you know, where do you stand, you know? You instinctively think, well, I'm with the guys who won't do what they're told, you know, because oppression is a bad thing. But on the other hand, if you don't do what you're told, you can't achieve anything, you know. Humans achieve things by doing things in groups. I'm very glad to be here in this very civilized Western society, but, you know, other people have paid a hell of a price over the last several thousand years so that I can be here and enjoy the fruits of it. How do I feel about that? It's a very iffy area. And of course, it's also a very an area without redemption, let's say, because you can't find a comfortable solution to this. You know, that's just the way things are, and it's horrible. And whenever I run across something that is, you know, just the way things are and it's horrible, I'm always very interested, because I think that's something we shy away from far too much in our society, whether it be the question of how the meat that we eat is slaughtered, or issues of violence in society generally, or the question of drugs or terrorism. There's a shying away from the sort of the nastier end of this stuff. We don't like to think about it in real terms. We mythologize what it's all about. And I'm very interested in that, because I think, you know, the only, as you'll know from a previous novel, one of my secondary characters says, you know, face the facts. That's the only mantra that she has, this character. You have to face the facts. And whenever I see human beings not facing the facts, I'm always fascinated to know why that is.
You talk a lot about, in this book, about what it means to be human. And you do talk about this idea that we now live in a feminized society. That's what you call it. And you bring up a lot, and you also have these women you call the bonobos.
Yes, right. It's kind of unkind, isn't it?
It's somewhat unkind, yes. And so you have a lot of kind of misogynistic ideas bubbling underneath the surface of this book, because you don't seem very happy with the living in a feminized society, although you recognize that it must be.
No, that's not the case at all. I am a feminist. If men are allowed to be feminists, I'm not sure what the party line on that is at the moment. But I am a feminist, and I'm very much in favour of feminising societies, because if you look around the world, as I mentioned in the novel, you pretty much can index link, what status women enjoy in society, how much power women have, with how pleasant it is to live in that society. And generally speaking, the more power and influence women have, the nicer society it is, to inhabit. Women are not good at might makes right, obviously, because, compared, the average woman is much weaker than the average man. So, from a very, very early period in our evolutionary history, women were just not going to be up for this kind of beating each other's skulls in game, because they were always going to lose. So the women that evolved from that context were women who found a way to think their way around that. And I think that's an enduring context. Women are much more up for negotiation rather than confrontation. They're much more interested in maintaining a sort of a comfortable status quo for everybody than sort of asserting how important they are compared to everybody else. That's not to say that, women are nice and men are nasty. I mean, obviously not. Women want what they want in much the same way that men want what they want. The difference is that what women want generally seems to be less socially catastrophic. what women seem to want generally is to have a reasonably comfortable existence so that they can reproduce and bring up their children in an environment of safety.
That's not the environment we have in this book. This is a...
No, not at all. But what men seem to want is basically to be the biggest motherfucker on the block and have everybody else doing what they say. And, clearly that is an unfulfillable dream, because not everybody can be the biggest mother on the block. So, yeah, it's not that I'm not a woman worshipper. I'm not a gynidolatra, is it? But I see very clearly that feminizing our societies is a way to get a better society. And I mean, again, if you look at development economics now, the big thing that the development economists are now saying is we have to find ways to get the aid money to the women, because if you give the aid money to the women in these societies, they will spend it in ways that benefit their children and the community at large. If you get it to the men, they drink it and piss it up against a wall or buy an expensive truck,
And what's wrong with an expensive truck?
Absolutely. We all love these things. But that's the whole point. It's simply that, what women want is more congruent with what would make a nice society than what men want. And that's really as far as I take that argument. As far as the misogyny goes, again, uncomfortable facts. It is becoming increasingly apparent that there are very different modular differences between male and female brains. And this is genetic. This is you are born this way. Men have a much, much greater capacity for violence than women. This is not to say women can't be violent. It's just that men are much better at it, if you like. It's the first thing they reach for at a genetic level. And as I said, it makes sense, because, that violence is a losing game for most women. Women might find some way to get a man to do their violence for them. I mean, that's another whole story. But so, yes, it's becoming apparent that there is no question that male and female brains are wired differently at quite a basic level. This is not to say that, therefore I think women shouldn't become engineers because they're not wired. I mean, that's bullshit. Men and women should have the opportunity to become whatever they want. But that is not the same thing as trying to say that men and women are kind of blank slate humans all, and they're all the same inside, and it's just a question of physical difference. That has been pretty conclusively demolished by, geneticists and other scientists. And the only reason it still hangs on is because the social science lobby are terrified. They don't like this idea. And because they don't like it, they are kicking and screaming as they're dragged towards the scientific reality of it. So when I talk about the bonobo variant, these are women who have had this tendency not to be violent, tweaked to an extent that they are very, very compliant.
Or so it seems, because what becomes apparent as the book goes on is that, I mean, you don't meet many bonobos, but what becomes apparent is that this bonobo tendency, it's not what people think it is, you know. And these women may be compliant in the sense that they don't smash you in the face or you know, run you over in or whatever, but that doesn't mean they haven't got their agendas and they haven't got very smart ways of getting what they want by other means. So, if it's... There will be a certain radical feminist element who will say that, that just to say that men and women's brains are different is in itself misogynistic. Well, you know, if that's the case, hey, bust me. But I think, as I think Steven Pinker says in one of his books, he says if feminism or radical feminism insists on sticking with this idea that, you know, men and women are blank slates and, you know, that there aren't, these differences don't exist, then they're tying themselves to the railway track because, you know, the train is coming and it's going to be time where we just say, well, no, that's not what the facts indicate. You know, conversely, look, again, conversely, looking at the issue of race, which arises in the book, what's been done very, very, very effectively and for quite a long time now, I mean, I think 1972, 74, a guy called Lewontin pretty much demonstrated that, you know, race in terms of whether you are African or Caucasian or Asian, That is a very, very minimal thing in genetic terms. And the amount of difference between an average African and an average Asian or an average Asian and an average Caucasian is nowhere near as large as the specific differences between two individuals taken from one of those race pools. So, you know, apart from a bunch of crackpot white supremacists down in Alabama, no one takes that shit seriously anymore. You know, the race thing has just been, that's been demolished scientifically. And that's why I give no credence to it in the book. But the issue of the way in which men and women are different at a psychological level, that very much is turning out to be a truth. And that's why I'm, you know, that's why it's in the book as such.
You have a lot of fun with American politics. So tell us a little bit about Jesus Land, where it came from.
Well, you know, I have to say, first of all, I didn't invent this, you know. It was an American who created the Jesus Land map, put it up on the website. It was after the 2004 elections, and you had basically all the red states that had voted for Bush in the middle, and then you'd got Canada, and Canada is joined to Washington State, Oregon, and California down one coast, and then all the sort of the New England and the northeastern corner down the other coast. And it also takes in, I think, Michigan. That's all kind of blue and joined. And so that lot is called the United States of Canada. And then the pink bit, the red states bit, is just called Jesus Land. There's an American who invented that. And there's another variant on the same thing where the Jesus Land component is called Dumbfuckistan, which I liked as well. So, you know, it wasn't my idea, but I the more I looked at that and the more I read what political commentators were saying about these kind of fractures that have appeared between the two Americas, the more it seemed like a very interesting idea. And the more you look into the psychology of the Republican right, the more you find that it's dominated by some very visceral and therefore, I would guess, genetically derived tendencies, attitudes like, you know, fear of the other, terror of what's outside, you know, xenophobia, to meld people together against the enemy that's outside.
The witch.
The witch, exactly, yeah.
Kill, I mean, the witch.
So it seemed to me that since I was writing a book about those things, this was also the time to explore this political element of America as well. So in the book, the future that I envisage 100 years from now, what's happened is that America has fractured apart along roughly those lines. So you have a northeastern corner, which is centered more or less on New York and has pretty much become a kind of a sort of UN-compliant default European state. The West Coast has been influenced increasingly by the Pacific Rim. And again, I mean, this is taken from books I stole from my wife's studies. She's one of the modules in the courses that she was studying was about Pacific Rim development. And it's saying that increasingly Western United States is looking out across the Pacific rather than in towards the heartland. And that's in ethnic terms, in the case of who's living here, it's in economic terms, the business that's done and so forth, and is it, and also to some extent, obviously, in cultural terms. So the idea is that those states have fractioned off and they've called themselves the Rim States and they are now part of a Pacific Rim understanding, if you like. And they've turned their back on the heartland of America. And there are various reasons for that, which I don't want to go into now because I don't want to spoil too much of the book. And then the rest, what you're left with of Heartland America becomes this very unreconstructed and kind of increasingly angst-ridden and inward-looking and angry cultural wilderness. And again, the sense is that, yes, you know, if you don't reach out to what's outside, you inevitably will damage yourself, and you just sort of close in and become increasingly locked up about things. And so the idea is that you reached a tipping point, and those tendencies have just gone their separate ways, and it's torn America apart. But it's worth pointing out that, you know, this is, you know, as this appears in the book, it's a lament for America. It's really a sense of, one of the characters who is an American says, you know, I can't believe it's come to this. You know, how did we do this to ourselves? Because, you know, I mean, I like America. America's been very good to me. The two literary awards that I've picked up so far have both been given to me by American committees. My books sell well here. Almost all the Americans I've met have been really nice to me, including those I've met in, you know, the Jesus Land portion, you know, in the southern states and in the Midwest. So I don't have an axe to grind here, but I kind of, it depresses me to watch America tearing itself apart like this. I would like America not, you know, to sort of settle down and be much more, you know, Canadian in its outlook, if you like. The book is an expression of that. It's a kind of, you know, oh, God, guys, please don't do this, you know.
Don't you find it rather ironic that you originally titled your book Black Man in the UK, and that was for a specific plot-oriented reason, because in part it's about racism, it's part of the theme of the book. Here, it's titled 13.
Yeah.
And also, when you read the dust jacket copy on the UK version, you get a sense of the setup, and part of this has to do with an illegal abortion, and none of which you'd find reading the American version.
No.
I mean, the American version was practically, it was almost as if it was published in Jesus Land.
Well, I don't know. You'd have to talk to my publisher about that. I think possibly because the markets involved are bigger, or possibly just because of the cultural difference, I think publishing in America is a much more nervy profession than in the UK. And, I mean, my London editor, when the book wasn't originally called Black Man, the book was originally called Normal Parameters. And my editor in London sat me down and he said, "Ah, that's a crap title, you know, like that. Come up with something else." So I sat around and I thought about it. And,
Simon?
Simon Spanton, yeah. Okay. He's a great editor.
Oh, yes.
He'll always tell you what's on his mind. Doesn't spare me. So I went away and thought about it, and I came back and said, well, look, the book concerns this guy who is black, and also he's got this genetic modification, which, in a sense, he's the future's equivalent of a black man, because he's treated with the same sort of fear and hatred as black people are treated in you know, contemporary context. So, or black men certainly are treated in the contemporary context, and so we could call it Black Man. So my London editor goes, "Ah, that's a great idea. That's what we'll do. I'm off to brief the cover." You know, and I hadn't even written the thing at that stage. He comes back with this kick-ass cover with, you know, the big black guy in silhouette on the front and so forth. And I really he sent me this email saying, "Here's what we've come up with. I think it's really powerful. What do you think?" And so I mailed him back saying, "Yeah, it's really powerful. Now I have to write a book that backs it up." But yes, I mean, I felt that we were onto something here. I felt that it did encapsulate something that I was trying to get to, you know, this idea of fear of these sort of shadowy figures and witches and big black men coming to steal your woman and, you know, whatever it might be. But
monsters.
Monsters, yeah. I felt I'd got hold of something here. And then when I told my London editor that, I said, you know, they're going to change it. They're not happy with the title in the US. And he was just bemused. He said, "I don't understand it." He said, "What, they're scared that there'll be controversy. Controversy sells books, you know." It's like Sam Goldwyn apparently said once, you know, publicity is good, and good publicity is even better if you can get it. But if you can't, bad publicity will do, you know, that being the implication. You know, if people are going to pick up the book thinking, Black Man, hell, what's that about? My sense of it was, well, that controversy can't be a bad thing, surely. My publishers in New York obviously thought it would be, so, you know, they were very unhappy. I mean, they didn't force the change. They just kept saying how uncomfortable they were and how unhappy. And in the end, I just said to them, "All right, well, look, change it. I don't mind, because it wasn't called Black Man before. So, you know, in my European books, very often they don't just translate the title of the book into the language that it's being translated into. The Swedish version of Altered Carbon is not called whatever the Swedish for Altered Carbon is. It's called 7-11 Celsius, because apparently Altered Carbon doesn't work in Swedish. You know, it just doesn't sound good. So, you know, it would have been a bit, stroppy of me to start sort of saying, you're not changing the title of this book. Del Rey are here on the ground. You know, they are Americans and they live and work and publish in America. So I just thought, okay, fair enough. If you know, if you think this is what works, then we go with that. You know, there's no point in buying a dog and then barking yourself. You know, you know, I have an American publisher because the American publishers are you know, they know what they're doing in America. So I you know, I'm not fussed. I'm really not fussed. But it is a bit ironic because I did say at the time, I said, well, I think if you change the title, you're not going to get rid of your controversy, because you're just going to end up with a new controversy. Because the controversy, instead of being, here's a book called Black Man written by a white guy, you're going to have a book that was called Black Man in the UK and now in the US has been changed to 13. And that, in a sense, is almost more interesting.
I found it much more interesting. I was glad.
So, you know, who knows? I don't know. Only time will tell. I mean, the book is selling well and, you know, everyone seems happy. So I'm fine with that. I'm very happy for it to be read by anybody, black or white, and then to be called on what's in it, you know, either way. I've had a couple of sort of comments from black people who've read it. I had one very generous review from a black reviewer and writer up in Seattle, and she was very kind. I mean, she pointed out a couple of things where she felt that, you know, as an African American, she didn't buy the blackness of this character in a couple of points because I'd failed to get certain sort of little things right. But you know, aside from that, it was a very, you know, it was a very positive review, and it was very generous. I'm very grateful, and also very glad that she liked it. You know, that she enjoyed the novel. And to say, I've had a number of other black people who've read it, and I've said, oh yeah, you know, it was good. They liked it. That, you know, I'm happy with that.
Is this novel? As I was reading this novel, it seemed like it might be set to a certain extent a prequel for the Takeshi Kovacs future. you really seem to be going back and. Retrofitting it?
Well, no, not at all. It was a conscious step away from the Kovacs books because, first and foremost, because the subject matter, you're dealing with like mortality and unavoidable mortality and the prison of your own flesh, the fact that you are who you physically are, you can't get out of that. And of course, in Kovacs' world, you can. You know, in Kovacs' world, you don't have to die. And in Kovacs' world, you can, if your skin is black and you don't like that, you can shed it and take on a different color skin.
Well, thematically, it's quite different. But I mean, it looks like you can. This future leads to Kovacs.
Yeah. Well, it has similar themes running through it, and there's a similarity of like there's a colony on Mars and so forth.
Right.
But that's really just because I think any book that is writing any book about the future more than sort of 20 or 30 years into the future, you've got to have a colony on Mars because it's going to happen. I mean, that's absolutely going to be the case. I'm pretty sure it won't be the way I've described it, but there will be people on Mars. That's coming, you know. And I think to write a future in which that doesn't happen is very, very unrealistic, if you like. But yeah, a number of people, once they'd read it, did actually sort of get in touch, or they reviewed it and they said, you know, this is a, you know, prequel. And one of them, in fact, had this really neat explanation. He said, there's all this Mars tech, the technology that's being used in the Martian colony, which is very, very advanced and much better than anything that's available on Earth. And of course, we all know where this is coming from. This has been raided from the Martian civilization that they found, but no one knows about it. This is a really subtle point, but it doesn't. And that's just not true. But I'm reading that and I'm thinking, shit, that was a really good idea. Why didn't I think of that? But sadly not. I mean, no, the Mars tech is human. It's just that the corporations have got a whole planet to play with and very few people on it, so they can pretty much do what they want. There's no real restraint on research, and so what they're coming out with is much faster and faster developing than what goes on back on Earth, and that's why the Mars. Plus, the whole it's become a brand. You know, Mars tech has become cool. But it's human. There are no Martians in this universe. You know, it's
not yet.
No. Well, no, not at all. Not at all. There aren't any at all.
One of the themes of this book that I really liked was the theme of regret. And Marsalis says this a couple times. Only do what you can live with, and live with what you can do.
Yeah, live with what you've done.
Live with what you've done.
It's certainly the entire book. I already said it's a kind of a lament. For a lost America and a lament for a sort of lost potential. I think it's if you like, it's almost a swan song for the alpha male. It's a kind of a sense that, you know, this is, I mean, it's very much like Paradise Lost, you know, that this kind of whole idea of this ultra tough, you know, hero. That's Lucifer in Paradise Lost, and it's so attractive, it's so powerful and magnetic and so forth, but ultimately it's a losing game. And so this is a kind of an attempt to sort of set that in context and say, my God, it is magnificent, but you got to turn your back on this. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly the entire book is filled with regret. But to some extent, I think most of my books are. I think I'm possibly just a sort of gloomy kind of guy.
I really liked all the characters in this book. They're all very complex and three-dimensional. And they all seem to really kind of leap off the page. Tell me how you came up with major secondary characters as full and rich as your primary characters, and then how you kept everything in balance so that we knew who to care about.
Right, well, that's, you know, presupposing that I did keep it in balance, and there are certainly reviewers out there who feel that I didn't. As I said, the book definitely, I feel stylistically, is a kind of a notch up. And one of the points about that was that I really just, everything I wrote, I threw my heart into. And so when I was developing characters, to be fair, often I was developing characters without really knowing how much of a part they would play later in the book. But I was, every character I developed, I tried to really get inside of and see from their own perspective. And I have to say, looking back at it now, and I think this is probably the first time I've managed this, I don't think there are any people in this book that I really see as bad guys. They're all sympathetic if you can just get into the right position to see them from. And certainly, yeah, with the minor characters, I would be writing the character and then something would crop up. There would be some hook or angle that I could hang the character off, and it would be like, that's the element of sympathy. That's where you go for this. And it dovetailed very nicely with what I was trying to do, because, again, there is the sense that it's not really anybody's fault as such what's happened. And possibly this is why some people haven't liked the book, because you come away from the end of it with a sense of there's been a lot of violence and a lot of mess and a lot of bloodshed, but none of it has been to... It hasn't been to any great purpose, or at least it hasn't been to the purposes that the people who've shed the blood have set out with. I kind of hope that, you know, each character who died, I mean, there are some who just, they're cannon fodder, you know, you don't know anything except they appear, they get shot, you know, it's the, you know, the red shirts from Star Trek. There are a few of those. But hopefully every character that you know anything about who dies, you feel something for, and you feel that you know, there's a loss there. I mean, again, interestingly enough, you know, I'm sort of still bracing myself for the hate mail from you know, Midwest and Southern United States. I really tried to balance this and to the few characters who are you know, of Jesus Land origin, as it were. I've really tried to give them sympathetic angling so that you don't sort of feel, ah, they're a bunch of redneck thug hicks. You know, these are real people and they're, you know, they're as human as anybody else. And you know, there's one particular character who initially was a bit of a cipher, and the more I wrote him, the more I started to sympathise with him. And you end up feeling that, you know, although he's completely screwed up by his sort of upbringing and the way he's been twisted by this kind of Republican right outlook on the world, what you've got beneath that is a really fine young man, potentially, you know. And it's a tragedy that he ends up the way he does, rather than saying, ha ha, look at this fucking stupid guy from Hicksville. You're not saying that. You're saying that this is a man who had huge potential, you know, a young man with all the right things that we look for in a young man. But he's destroyed by who he's become, by the way in which society has warped him. And to some extent, that applies to pretty much everybody who's in the book, you know, that you can get on their side without too much effort. And thus, when they die, no matter what the context, you kind of feel a sense of loss. You feel that, God, that shouldn't have happened, you know. That guy should still be walking around. And, you know, if I've succeeded in doing that, then I'm very, very pleased, because I feel is a step up from what I've written previously.
There is a lot of violence in this book.
I know.
Some of it has, you have some really interesting combinations of religious imagery and violence. Have a Christ the Cannibal. not going to make a lot of people happy.
Well, not people who take their religion seriously, no. I think we need to be honest about this. Religion is pretty nasty stuff. I mean, I'm an avowed atheist, so I would say that. But if you look at the sort of the ethos of religion, pretty much all religions, this applies to certainly all the ones I know anything about, with maybe not Buddhism, although again, I think if you dig, you can find some Buddhists doing some pretty nasty things in even quite recent political history. What you find really at the heart, certainly, of Islam, Christianity, Judaism, the sort of the dominant patriarchal religions, is a really misogynistic, violent, domineering kind of approach to the world. And I don't really see any reason to represent it any other way. I mean, I know that there's in vogue at the moment, there's this idea that you mustn't upset religious people, you know. You must take their ideas seriously. Why? Why is that, you know? If a guy comes in and says he's been abducted by aliens, you don't take him seriously. If a guy comes in and says he's been talking to Jesus on the phone, you don't take him seriously either. I don't get it, you know. I do not get it. And yes, I think religion, you know, if you look at, let's take Christianity specifically, you know, because, I mean, there's been a lot said about Islam and violence, and I don't really want to retread that. But let's take Christianity for a moment. You know, so many born-again Christians who are, you know, practically salivating as they anticipate the return of Christ and the destruction of the material world, you know, and the sending to hell of millions of human beings just because they didn't sign along the right dotted line in religious terms. You know, and these people, they either haven't thought this through or they are tapping into some very unhealthy tendency in their psyche and their makeup. You know, and I can remember even back when I was a student talking to born-again Christians, and there, you know, one in particular who had a roommate that I was seeing, that I was dating at the time, who was also an atheist. And I remember saying to the religious one, I said, so, you know, your mate, your friend Judy, is going to burn in hell when she dies. And she said, oh, yes, yes. And I'm saying, but you're going to be in heaven, so she'll be there tortured for eternity in a variety of really unpleasant ways, and you're going to be enjoying ambrosia and kicking back, relaxing with the angels. Doesn't that bother you? And she said, well, you know, she's had her choice. You know, she has rejected Jesus Christ as her personal saviour, and so she's going to hell, and that's her fault. And I'm saying, yes, but, you know,
wake up and smell the burning flesh.
You know, how comfortable will you be with that? Could you sit in a room with a, you know, with a torturer and watch them apply branding irons to your friend? You know, would you be comfortable with that? And if you wouldn't be comfortable with it, how is it going to be okay as an afterlife? And again, it seems to me Christians who believe that kind of shit just have not thought this through. They haven't done the math. And but they still believe it. They're still comfortable with it. So you know, by importing these rather violent connections in the religious imagery in this book, I don't really feel that I'm doing anything, you know, that isn't written on the label. You know, it's not like you're opening this tin and finding that it isn't what says on the outside. You know, I'm delving into what's already there, I would say.
This is, like many of your books, a mystery, and you do a lot of fun stuff with mystery plotting. And I wonder if you care to talk about some of the skills that you've acquired as a writer trying to write mysteries that are set in the future.
Well, I don't know, because it was a nightmare trying to get the plot to work, I have to say. As I said, I just wrote a huge amount of stuff. And again, the characters got developed because I was interested in the characters. And to be honest, whether you like or don't like this novel is really going to stand or fall on how much you can sort of connect with the characters. If you connect with the characters, you're going to love it. If you, for whatever reason, don't connect with the characters, then I don't think you'll enjoy it that much, because it's not that fast-paced. I don't know. I mean, I don't actually feel that I've learnt a huge amount in mystery plotting since I wrote Altered Carbon. I guess I must have done, because there are some rather nice reversals that sort of come out in the text. And a couple of them where I've now looked back once they were written and thought, oh, that is quite nice. That is quite a twist. But I didn't those were not designed. They kind of dropped on me. I suddenly thought, oh, that's where we're going with this. And so when the twists came, they emerged from the mess, as it were, rather than me sitting there plotting them well ahead of time. And in a sense, maybe that's why they work as twists, because if I didn't know it was going to happen, then it's pretty sure no one who's reading the book is going to guess that it's going to happen. It's not false modesty here. I'm not convinced have learnt a great deal, as a mystery writer, or indeed that I am an especially good mystery writer. You know, I'm glad that you think so, and I'm kind of hoping that other readers will think so as well. But I did not come away from this book thinking, wow, I'm so much better at plotting these things now than I was 5 years ago. That I didn't have that sensation. Maybe I am, I don't know. But if I am, it's an unconscious thing.
Let's talk about your characters. In particular, the one who really interested me was Segvi.
Sevki, yeah.
Sevki. Tell us a little bit about how you came to create that character and some of the aspects of her personality, which are really interesting, particularly her religion.
Yeah, well, I lived and worked in Turkey for about a year, a little over a year, and I had a Turkish girlfriend for a while, and I was pretty much integrated into the society. And I'd always wanted to write a novel with a Turkish woman at the centre of it, because I felt that Turkey really is the crossroads between the Islamic world and the Western world. It's a secular society made up of 99.9% Muslims, and it is, despite its many flaws, because, you know, I mean, I'm not going to start, you know, cheerleading for Turkey. It's got a lot of very serious problems to resolve, to do with human rights issues. But to some extent, as an experiment in secular Islam, as an experiment in a kind of a moderate Islamic society run on secular lines, it is a success. And certainly if you compare it with any other Islamic state, it is a massive success. And it always seemed to me that this was a very, and also, of course, geographically, you know, Istanbul is the bridging point between East and West. It's the Bosporus, the whole thing of crossing from Europe into the East. It seemed to me that there was always going to be room for a character who had taken on board the westernizing influences of the Ataturk Revolution and was in that sense Turkish, but very Western and secular, but at the same time was very much belonged to this Eastern tradition and belonged to her religion and so forth. And I started writing a novel with this character, and she wasn't called Sevgi, she was called something else. I started writing that novel many, many years ago, and then I stopped because I didn't have the time, or I couldn't go back and do the research. And when I was putting this together, I sort of thought, well, maybe I can use this now. And I started to write her, and once I sort of put her into as a New Yorker, you know, first generation American, but growing up in New York, with parents who are Turkish and a mother who, in fact, is quite strongly religious. But her growing up a streetwise New York kid. Once that started to roll, I was just thinking, there's a lot of mileage in this. I can do a lot with this. And yes, she's someone she's an intelligent woman. And I think basically, and this will be my atheist prejudice shining through again, her intelligence will eventually demolish her faith because, you know, those two are opposed, you know. She cannot take her faith seriously in the face of the events that are surrounding her, because it requires an abandonment of reason. And so she's just about hanging onto her faith when the book begins. But and whether she actually loses it or not is an arguable point. But what you see essentially is someone who's not prepared to just sit there and say, this is what I believe. I'm not prepared to rationalize it. It's also quite interesting because I really seriously believe that the future of Islam is in America. And that's a kind of weird thing to be saying.
That
right
is
now,
a very odd thing. Why do you believe that?
Because if you look at... I mean, Islam's not going to go away. I think this is one of the big problems with you know, the whole sort of the Bush way of dealing with the Middle East. You know, Islam is not something that can be squashed or put aside or whatever. It's a massively successful religion. It's not going to go away. But what will happen to it eventually is that it will modernize and it will secularize. It will basically water itself down in the same way that Christianity has watered itself down. Where that's most likely to happen is in the West. And in fact, if you look at what's going on in the Islamic world, when by that I mean the world of people who are Muslims, it's in New York that you have women leading prayers for the first time in centuries. It's in New York that you have the idea that women, you know, have just as much rights in the mosque as men. It's in America that the traditionalism of Islam is being challenged most effectively. It's not being challenged in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan or Palestine. Very much the opposite, in fact. I mean, there's a retrenchment going on there. And so, yeah, as far as I can see, in 100 years' time, you're going to have a large number of Muslims in America. I don't think they'll be the dominant religion or anything, but certainly far more than you have now. And most of them will be like the American Muslims you have at the moment. They'll be successfully integrated into American society. They'll consider themselves Americans, you know, as well as Muslims, which is a trick we haven't managed to do with our Muslims in the UK yet. And they will be the moderating influence. That's where the moderation is going to come from. And that's what's going, you know, that's the future of Islam, you know, such that it has a positive future. So it seemed to me that this was a great idea, that I could, you know, take this character and go with this. This is a modern Islamic woman 100 years from now, whose outlook on her religion is perhaps not dissimilar to Christians now, who you know, the kind of Christians who are desperately sort of going through their faith, trying to find ways to make it stay attached to a modern secular world. And ultimately, I think anyone who does that is doomed to failure. And that's why we're seeing a retrenchment in both Christianity and Islam. But, you know, you've got to give those people credit for trying, because at least they are attempting to live their faith rather than just hide in the basement.
Tell us what you've got planned next. Have you started another book?
Yeah, I'm writing a fantasy now. All kind of accidental thing. I have had for a while these kind of character vignettes from a fantasy context that I wrote almost for fun. And in fact, Gordon Van Gelder had one of them as potentially was going to publish it as a short story, but then he decided that it didn't go anywhere because it was just a vignette. And anyway, I had these and I kind of passed them over to my London editor to have a look at. Just, you know, he said, "Oh, well, yeah, let me read them." So he read them, and then he comes to me and he says, "Wow, these are great. These are great. So, you know, how many books is this?"
And I go, hey, they're always looking for a fantasy series, a trilogy, right?
And I look at him and I say, "Well, it's, you know, it's a book, you know." And he goes, it's a kind of Godfather moment, you know. "I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse." He goes, "How many books is this, Richard?" So I go, "Three." He goes, "Correct. Have a contract." And that was it. And I'm now signed up to write a fantasy trilogy. Which is enormous fun, I've got to say. I mean, it's a whole... I mean, I you know, we've talked before about this, so you know that I'm always looking to try to do something different each time, to try and stay fresh. I hate the idea of becoming a hack. And so, yeah, it's interesting because it's a whole other arena. I'm bereft of my usual technological metaphors and the sort of fast cyberpunk type world, the kinetics of that world. Everything takes ages in this world. You know, you've got to get on a horse and spend like a month crossing the desert to go from one city to another. It's fascinating. It's proving to be quite hard work, harder work than I thought it would be, certainly. But at the same time, it's a lot of fun. It's something new, and
How are you going to get your books are always very political.
Yeah,
and how are we going to have a political fantasy?
Well, it's okay. Well, you know, one of the things that I noticed about, and I confess, I stress here, I haven't read much fantasy in the last few years, and most of the fantasy I read was back when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. So I may have a slightly old-fashioned view of fantasy. But one of the things that seems to recur in fantasy novels and fantasy series is the idea of the big war. You know, an evil arises, usually in the East, and everyone has to go and bash it. And I mean, the Tolkien is the Tolkien template. This is where everything derives from, this idea of you know, the evil arises and the forces of light rally, and eventually, after much suffering, they defeat the forces of evil. And I'd always thought that there's a far more interesting book to be written as a sort of fourth part of the Tolkien trilogy is the aftermath of the War of the Ring. You know, because, I mean, generally speaking, you look at the aftermath of the First and Second World Wars, and it's such a mess. You know, you've got all these guys coming back, these veterans who are totally fucked up. You know, they can't reintegrate into society, or they're missing limbs or eyes or whatever. You know, the way in which, and again, I mean, in America, you've had this, you know, with the whole Vietnam thing and the sort of post-Vietnam experience as well, what's happened to the guys who fought in Vietnam and came home, you know, to very much not to the hero's welcome that they'd thought they'd receive. And we're now seeing the same shit again. It's one of the things that makes me so angry about the Bush administration, that they've essentially managed, you know, after 30 years of common sense, to actually put you back into Vietnam, essentially. Here's another war where we can kill lots of young Americans, bring them home in body bags, or bring them home so fucked up that they can't live their lives. Great. Nice one, George. Anyway, so it always struck me that there will be an interesting fourth book to be written after the War of the Ring is concluded. And what I'm writing, I mean, obviously, I wouldn't be allowed to do that. What I'm writing is a story that takes place after a similar large war has been fought to defeat, in this case, a bunch of guys called the Scaled Folk. And they are a sort of reptilian evolved race.
Well, we love monsters. That's right up my alley.
But they won't actually be in the, certainly not in the first novel. They are really there as a sort of just a mention. And this war is now over. And the story really concerns three veterans of that war who've gone back to their separate lives and are trying to cope with the aftermath. And one of the points is that as the book goes on, as the story develops, because there's a sort of a new threat emerges, as the story develops, you're also getting flashbacks, you're also getting insights into what happened at the, when this war was fought. And what basically happened is these guys were betrayed and they feel very bitter about the way that that things turned out. It's also the case that in of the three, two of them are homosexual. There's one who, a woman and a man. They are both homosexual. And obviously, this is a kind of, you know, mock medieval setting where, you know, being homosexual is really kind of hazardous to health. So there's all, because I was looking for a way, I wanted to import the Kovac sensibility into this. And the problem with importing Kovac into a medieval world is he will get his head cut off in Nothing Flat, because you just don't get to mouth off to people in that context. You know, it's like you start smart mouthing the local liege lord and he'll just have you tortured to death, you know, and there's no comeback from that. So I was looking for a way in which I could find characters who would have that distance on their own society, would be outsiders. And of course, again, genetics comes to my rescue once again. You know, if you are born sexually differently, if your sexual orientation is such that you are an outcast and you cannot show what you are for real, immediately you're apart, you're set apart. Immediately you're going to have a distanced vision of the world that's around you. And so the idea is that, say, perhaps the lead character, who's the male gay guy, he is extremely jaundiced about in his view of everything that's going on in this world. One, because of his veteran status and the sort of the way he's seen everything he fought for pissed away. But also because from a very early age, he's had this realization that he's not like the rest, and that the rest would hate him if they can only find out what he's like. So, I mean, I've been told I'm taking a big risk here, you know, fantasy novel with a gay protagonist. I do believe it's been done before a couple of times, though I don't recall by whom. But anyway, I was, you know, fantasy is very often read by sort of teenage boys. And, you know, the whole idea of putting that whole questionable sexuality thing in there is possibly going to upset a few people. But hey, you know, that's why I'm here. but also I also love the idea of a gay guy who is also a really mean swordsman. So, you know, this is not someone that you're gonna start queer baiting, because no. He's just going to produce a weapon and skewer you with it. There's a very hard edge on this. This guy is, you know, I mean, he picks his clothes with great care, and he's a sensitive guy in many ways. He has, you know, sort of a better relationship with his mum than with his father. But when all is said and done, he's also a man who knows how to slaughter with the best of them. And, you know, you start calling him names in the street, you're going to find yourself cut in pieces very, very rapidly. And that always appealed to me, the idea of the tough gay. I think that's a nice... You know, it comes away from the usual gay characters you find in fiction, with this sort of sensitivity and a sort of a non-violent element to them. Oddly enough, I owe Rod Stewart for that. I don't know if we've got time to deal with that.
Well, you can.
Okay. I can't believe it. I mean, there's a Rod Stewart song called The Killing of Georgie. I don't know if you've ever heard it. It's a ballad. And it's about a gay guy who he grows up in. I think the idea is that he grows up in a small Scottish village, or it might be that he grows up somewhere in a small town in America. Anyway, he's thrown out by his family when he tells them what he is, and he goes to New York, and he makes it big in the gay scene in New York, becomes a very successful man about town, and is seen at all the sort of opening nights of Broadway shows and things like that, and basically is very happy. And the last verse tells how the singer meets him one night after a show, and that he tells him that he's in love for real this time, and he says he's really pleased for him. And then he leaves the show early, presumably to go and meet his new boyfriend and this guy that he's finally found love with. And he runs into a New Jersey street gang and gets in a fight with them. And the enduring image I'm left with is the fact that rather than getting beaten to a pulp, he gets in a fight with these guys, and he's quite a fighter, you know, and... The reason he dies is because he just gets stabbed in the confusion, and he falls and bashes his head on a curbstone, and that's just too much. By the time the MT guys show up, he's, you know, he's dead. And I always, you know, from very early age, because I remember that song from when I was like 14, I guess. I always liked that image of this guy who is, you know, gay, and therefore, and very much, it's also that he's very much in tune with the gay scene in New York. So the kind of the over the topness and the sort of the ridiculous queening and so forth. But at the same time, put to the test, he turns out to be a pretty mean street fighter, you know, and he gives a good account of himself, although, you know, he dies. And I just remember thinking it was a really nice story. I liked it. And it's a good song, too. Killing of Georgie, Rod Stewart. But anyway, that has definitely fed into this character. I like the idea of this guy being lean and mean and tough, as well as, let's say, having a great, great dress sense.
Now, you're here for Comic-Con.
Yes.
And you're still writing the Black Widow comics, or have you done?
No, that's died a death. They did not sell. They let me write a second series. It was very nice of them, because even the first series didn't sell that well. I mean, we started selling, I think, 40-something thousand copies. By the time we got to issue 6, we were down to 20-something thousand. And in comic book terms, that's a disaster. Even 40,000 isn't great for comic books. It's ironic, because if I sold 40,000 copies of any of my prose novels, then my publishers would be dancing in the aisles. But in comic terms, 40,000 just isn't a lot of comics. You need to be selling hundreds of thousands before you're, really, really a big success. So anyway, it started at 40,000 and then it dropped, and that's a big no-no. But they were kind enough, Marvel were kind enough to let me write. There was a lot of talk about getting me to write a different character, but I didn't really want to. I was enjoying the character of the Black Widow. They were kind enough to let me write a second series, a second limited edition, limited series, 6 more, which carried on the story. And again, these just did not sell in the required quantities, and so it just sort of came to an end. And, I've not really been in touch with Marvel since, and they've sort of been very quiet, and they got other fish to fry. And in the end, they're in business to sell comics, and I didn't sell many comics for them, so it's there's no rancor there. It's a mismatch of what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. and what they thought I could do, and what the comic book audience, the core Marvel readership, want from their writers. So that's the way it goes. It was a lot of fun, and I now get to play at the misunderstood auteur without actually, having to suffer the financial consequences of that. So, it's all good.
Well, what are you doing at Comic-Con then?
Well, I'm on a couple of panels, but I'm there really. My publishers are taking me down there. I'm not a guest. I was a guest back in 2005, but I'm not going as a guest of the con this time. I'm down there. I'm on a couple of panels because they've got stuff they'd like me to talk about. But I'm being taken there really for exposure and publicity. But I mean, the comic book door is still open. People at Marvel and also people at DC have been very nice to me and mm-hmm. have always said, any ideas you have, get in touch. Here's my card. Pitch to us. We'd love you to do something for us. And my own New York prose publishers have also said that if I'm interested in doing a graphic novel for them, they look into that as well. So those possibilities are there. And I may well go back and have a look at doing something in the future, because I really enjoyed it. I mean, it was a lot of fun. But I think it's pretty safe to say I won't be writing any more, core Marvel characters, or likewise DC characters. I mean, I'm not cut out to do superhero comics, basically. And that's or at least not cut out to write the superhero comics that people want to read. there's an important factor there. If no one's reading you, then you're not communicating. And I've always thought that writing has got to be an act of communication.
Are any progress on movies of Altered Carbon or Market Forces?
Altered Carbon renewed, the option renewed last month for another 18 months, and I'm told there's a lot of enthusiasm for the project still, but we are no further forward than we were when they started. There are still no big names attached. Well, obviously apart from Joel Silver and Silver Pictures, but I mean in terms of getting like a star or a director on board, there's no movement there. Market Forces comes up for renewal in November, I think. And I have no idea whether they'll renew or not. That's still out there. And I probably won't know until the week before they decide, or the week before it happens. So, we'll see. But, Hollywood, it's a very, very slow grinding machine. And nothing happens overnight there. So you just got to put it to the back of your mind and try not to think about it too much. Keep your fingers crossed, though.
Yes. We've been speaking with Richard Morgan. His new novel is titled Black Man in the UK and 13 in the United States. Thank you for joining me, Richard.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.